Here it is, another Saturday morning in CCU land, a little gray, a little damp, but we're going to talk wine with our friend Jack Farrell, or all sorts of things we talk about. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning, and today I thought we would talk about, Denny, answering some of the emails I get.
Oh, good.
And the questions, and it amazes me how some of these things keep coming back, so I may sound repetitious, but it's because so many people are interested in that particular topic.
Sure.
And I don't think it hurts to rehash. We all can learn a little bit more.
Absolutely.
And no one ever suffered from knowing too much, I don't think.
I don't think so.
Anyhow, somebody asked me, how do wines get their names? Well, that's really very simple. You know, obviously, if you were going to open up a vineyard, we'd call it Long Vineyards, and it'd be Denny's Vineyard. But the other names come from a lot of different things, usually geographic area. For example, Burgundy is a geographic area. Chablis is a geographic area. Tuscany is a geographic area. Then there's varietals, of course, and we all know that. Cabernet Sauvignon, Chardonnay, Merlot, Viognier, etc. are the varietals. Then there's, as I said, place names where they're named after a town like Chianti, etc. And then fantasy names. Fantasy names are my favorite. Everyone knows the word leaf brow milk, but what it means is virgin mother's milk. And, of course, that's an oxymoron, but there was a church in Germany, and everybody said to him, how come his wine was so much better? And the church sat right in the middle of Stephenson was the man's name's vineyard, and he said it's the milk of the virgin in the steeple of the church blessed the vineyards, and thus the name leaf brow milk was born. Another wine from Italy called Est was supposedly coined by a cardinal from Germany who was going to the Vatican to reelect a pope, and he sent ahead his servant to mark Est, where they thought they had good food and wine. And when he came to this little town in Italy, he was so taken with the food and wine, he wrote Est. So he emphasized it three times. So, therefore, that's how we get those names. Here's another thing. Somebody said to me, what about ice and wine? Well, that's a personal thing, and I don't see that there's anything wrong with that if you like your wine that way. You know, no one should feel self-conscious. There aren't any specific rules to enjoying something as simple as wine. And so if you like ice in your wine, by all means put it in. If you're worried about the ice diluting the wine, you know, they have these things now that are called rocks, and they go in the freezer. They're little blocks of metal or plastic or some kind of material, and you put them in the freezer, and then you can pour your drinks on them, and they don't dilute the drinks because they don't melt. But like ice cubes, they stay cold for quite a while. Another question that comes up all the time, and this is always amazes me, is why do you get the cork in a restaurant? What should we do when the waiter hands us the cork? Well, usually just touch it and say, yeah, it's fine, and let him go about his business. But the reason they give you the cork isn't to smell the cork, although most sommeliers will run it under their nose. A wine would have to be pretty bad for the cork to be tainted, so you could tell it was bad from smelling the cork. The reason you're given the cork is back at the turn of the last century, there were a lot of unscrupulous wine merchants, particularly in England. And chateau bottling wasn't known at that time at all. They shipped all the wine in hogsheads or barrels. So when they got the wine there, very often an unscrupulous wine merchant would order a barrel of Beaujolais, and then he would order Pommard and Volnay and expensive Burgundy labels and put it on that inexpensive Beaujolais. Well, they wanted to get around that, so they started branding. They started cork bottling and bottling at the vineyard, and they branded those corks. And so, therefore, if you order a really good bottle of wine, it'll have the name of the wine and the vintage on the cork. And that's the reason you're given the cork, is to ensure the authenticity of the wine that you have. Now, somebody else said, we have some very old wine. What's it worth? Well, generally, not much of anything. There's a very, very small percentage of wines that age well and are worth a lot of money. I've disappointed thousands of people in my career. Grandpa had a wonderful bottle of wine, and it's 100 years old or it's 60 years old, and they'd bring it in, and of course it was not any good anymore. Or most wines aren't meant for aging. In fact, when people ask me very often about investing in wine, I tell them that's a great idea, but be sure you're prepared to liquidate your investment at your own dining room table. Because frankly, there are very, very few people who have made a lot of money on investing in wine. It's wonderful to hear, oh, this wine's now worth $1,000 a bottle. Well, try and get it. And the auctions are few and far between, and most auction houses insist on solid cases and things like that. So wine, no pun intended, is not a very liquid investment. And as I said, if you're prepared to liquidate it at your own dining room table, it's a tremendous investment and a lot of fun. Now, what's my favorite wine? The one in my glass at the moment. There's so many different wines, and I think that to have a single favorite is pretty hard to do. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's just like the Miss America contest. Only one girl can be Miss America. The other 49 are beautiful, stunning, et cetera, but they aren't Miss America. So that's the same thing, in my opinion, with wines. They're all wonderful. Try them. There's nothing better in the world than an adventure in wine. And that adventure begins with getting a corkscrew, pulling out the cork, and there you have an adventure before you every time you do it. Now, how long should you keep wines? Well, generally not too very long. Most wines are meant to be drunk within a few years of their being bottled. Once in a while, you get a real surprise. I remember opening a bottle of Corbières that was 60 years old, and I thought, it won't be any good. Maybe I could cook a chicken and make coquevin. So I took it up to my kitchen and popped the cork, and it was absolutely delicious. I drank the whole bottle. It was a 60-year-old bottle of Corbières. It still had the price tag on it, 89 cents. So you know it wasn't very good, and it certainly wasn't very expensive, but it was an absolutely wonderful thing to try. Another question is, screw caps, are they worthwhile? Well, yes, very much so. You know, they've come a long way. I can remember we tried, when I had a vineyard in Italy, we decided we would try a screw cap and a cork finish, and we bottled a case of each, and we would open every year or two one of each side by side and see what happened. Well, the one with the Stelden cork, which is the screw cap, never changed. It never got any age, but it was fruity, delicious, like the day it was bottled. But the ones that had the cork aged a little bit. So screw caps aren't good for aging wine, but you're not aging wine. And I think on a lot of wines, we really learned a big lesson from the Kiwis in New Zealand. You know, most of their wines are sent out with screw caps in them, and even the real expensive ones. And I find that that's, you know, it's handy when you're on a picnic, et cetera. And screw caps have definitely come a long way. When they first came out, a lot of them weren't tight enough, et cetera, and the cork wasn't on the top in an efficient way. It could slide the one side or the other. Well, today they are much, much better, and I'd say there's absolutely nothing wrong with buying modestly priced wine with a screw cap. I think almost anything under $25. They've had some examples. There was one in California called Plump Jack, and it was a $150 bottle of wine, and they put it on in a screw cap bottle. Well, they didn't sell any because people felt that cheapened the wine. And so while I don't think it cheapens the wine, I do think if you have a very expensive bottle of wine, say over $50, people sort of expect a cork to be in there. And don't forget, as I said, when you see the cork in there, the cork is the way you can be sure of the authenticity of the wine you're getting. Anyhow, somebody else said to me, what about sulfites? Are there wines without sulfite? Well, yes, there are a few, not very many. Those, they're called natural wines. Even organic wines have a little bit of sulfite in them. They clean equipment with sulfur in wineries. And virtually every wine has a little bit of sulfites in it, even the ones that are so-called natural wines, a tiny bit. The best thing to do with any wine, if you're worried about that, is have somebody decant the wine for you. In other words, put it in a carafe, pour that carafe into another carafe, do that four or five times, and it will dissipate. 99% of all the sulfites will get dissipated by that aeration of the wine. And incidentally, someone asked about that, when should I put a wine in a carafe? Anytime. All wines benefit greatly from aeration. And aeration is simply what you're doing when you pour the wine into a carafe. You're aerating that wine. So it doesn't hurt with any wine. The real time you need a carafe and decanting is when the wine is older and there's sediment. And you have to be very careful when you pour that wine off of the lees or the sediment that you pour it slowly so it goes over the sediment. The sediment is heavier and falls to the bottom. And so when you're decanting an older wine, sometimes the decanting machine is handy. These are where it holds the bottle at an angle and you kind of turn a crank and the bottle gradually goes down and tilts. And you put a candle under it and you can see it. But if you haven't got all that equipment, you can very easily just put a flashlight there, pour the wine into the carafe over the flashlight, and you can see about the time the sediment starts to come to the neck, stop, and then you have the wine without the sediment. And the sediment, incidentally, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just unpleasant in there. Somebody asked, what about white and rosé wines? Well, they're really, what about them? There's white wine and there's rosé wine. Rosé is made, as we discussed a week or so ago, by leaving the skins intact with the wine for a very short period of time. Usually anywhere from 12 to 48 hours is all that the skins stay in touch. And then it gives the wine that pink hue or pink tinge or pale onion skin, whatever color you want to do, that's the difference between white and rosé wine. What do I look for in wine? Well, that's pretty simple. If you take any course on wine, they're going to teach you there's five things you look for: color, aroma, bouquet, taste, and aftertaste. And that's simple. The color, how does the wine look? Is it free of cloudiness or anything in it? It's nice and clear, the color's fine. The aroma, you swill it around in the glass, and does it smell like wine? Yeah, that's okay, too. The next thing is a little more complicated, is the bouquet. If it's Zinfandel, does it smell like a Zinfandel? Or if it's Cabernet, does it smell like a Cabernet? And that's when you get everyone with all their nuances and special vocabulary, etc. Then second to last is the taste. And how does it taste in your mouth? And then after you swallow it, the aftertaste. So those five things are what you look for in wine: color, aroma, bouquet, taste, and aftertaste. And if those are all in sync, whether you grade a wine 10 points, 100 points, 500 points, 3 points, whatever, those are the five ingredients for anybody who tastes wine, whether you're a top sommelier or you're a brand-new beginner with wines. So if you want to answer any wine questions, just send me an email, jfarrell@haskells.com, and I will compile them, and as I do here, once every year or two, twice every year, we'll answer your wine questions. And don't forget this. The only Latin I can remember from prep school is de gustibus non disputanum est. And that simply translates, in matter of taste, there can be no dispute. So if you like wine and you like red wine with trout, go ahead and have it. You only need to please yourself. You are the one that your palate pleases. So if you want to put ice in wine, go right ahead and put ice in wine. And don't let anybody badger you into saying that, well, these are wine rules. You have to follow them. The only wine rule you have to follow is that you enjoy what's in the glass.
Absolutely. Great show, Jack. And the only Latin I remember after 2 years of De La Salle High School is in vino veritas.
In wine, the truth.
Absolutely. Well, it's true that you guys at Haskell's have been in the business here, family owned for a long time.
85. 35 years, Haskell's has been supplying the wine needs of the community of the Twin Cities. That's why we're called the Wine People. And believe me, we love to talk about wine, and we love to solve your wine problems. So come on in. There's wonderful wines that from all. Saturday is a great day to visit the vineyards of the world at Haskell's. There's the Haskell's near you where you can save big dollars on wine. Bloomington, Excelsior, Faribault. Our super cellar up in Maple Grove is not to be missed. In Minneapolis, we have free parking on Saturday and Sunday at Minnetonka, at Ridgedale, Plymouth, St. Paul's Highland Village, Stillwater, White Bear Lake, and Woodbury, too. And if you can't come in to Haskell's, go to Haskell's.com. And incidentally, at the website of Haskell's.com, you can get the answers to a lot of these questions that I've talked about here today if you didn't get down real fast as I was talking so fast. So I'm sorry for that.
All right, Jack. Well, let's talk next week.
I'm going to look forward to sharing Memorial Day ideas with
you. Good deal. Thank you, Jack Farrell.